This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brandt. Imagine Star Wars without that hum of a lightsaber. Or Jurassic Park without the roar of the T-Rex. Or Saving Private Ryan without the explosions and bullets whizzing by GIs storming the beaches of Normandy on D-Day. None of these cinematic masterpieces would be the same. Sound effects and design are just as important to the mood, tone, and emotion of a film as what you see with your eyes on screen. Well, Midge Costin's new documentary is a love letter to the immersive world of Hollywood sound editing. It's called Making Waves. She's also a longtime Hollywood sound editor. She worked on Armageddon, Con Air, The Rock, among other films, and she teaches at USC's film school. And Midge Costin joins me now in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you.
So, sound design, it encompasses a lot.
Yes.
From the dialogue to the music to the sound effects to the bullying and all that stuff.
Yes. So on the set, the only thing they're really getting is the performance, so it's the voice. The sound design is everything. I mean, think about ambiences. It really sets a mood and a tone. I always think about it as kind of the music to every scene, but it's subtle.
Yeah. Like ambience being just the sound of life happening.
Yes.
The
sound of like a room or even a room tone. Like
right.
Room tones can sound different. And it would be like if it's raining or if it's windy or what does the house sound like? What's going on outside? Traffic, you know, so it's kind of the backdrop of in the sound wise.
And all of that is done in post?
All of it in post, yeah.
Yeah. And we don't even think about it as moviegoers.
No.
We are just in the moment, in the experience. We don't think about all of the work that goes on to create that experience.
Exactly.
Orally.
It's a good thing because we get to do all this stuff, but we don't pull you out of the movie. The whole point is it's not sound for sound's sake. We're always working with the director. And what does the director want? What's the intention for the scene? And you don't want to pull anyone out of the movie and think of sound, but then that leaves us like... Nobody thinks about us as doing things in the background.
Well, it used to be that the studios would have stock sounds.
Yes.
Right?
And yes.
You would say, okay, well, pull up the horse hooves, clip clopping,
yes.
And they would just have that.
Yes. And there's a sequence in the film that's really funny that's like the same gunshot. And it's like Warner Brothers would have their sound and Paramount would have their sound. And
so each just had a different gun sound?
Yes, but it would be the same sound for every movie, you know, every different movie. And even when I started cutting effects in the 80s, there were still like optical sounds in libraries. And what happened is when sound first came in, the studios sent like these big trucks, because that's what it took to record, all over the world. Like, you know, you'd see them go into Africa and they'd record things like the jungle. But then they didn't do anything for decades and everyone would just use the same effects.
Your film profiles a handful of pioneers in sound design, beginning with Murray Spivak, who did King Kong. And he created the sounds of King Kong.
I went to the Selig Zoo at the time. I got all the roars I needed. I then slowed those down to half speed. And I played the tiger growl backwards against the lion roar forward. And it gave me sort of an uncanny roar.
This is still what we use, the techniques in a big way that we use today.
Fast forward to the 70s onward, that's really the golden era of sound design. And there's a man that you profile named Walter Murch, who's in your documentary, really famous for Apocalypse Now and the sound of that. That the sound of Apocalypse Now is iconic.
Yes.
I just want to play a little clip of tape from him in your movie. And here he is talking about how Coppola was inspired by a four-track version of Gustav Holst's The Planets.
The idea was that you put speakers at each corner of your room and you sat in the center and you were surrounded by the music. Francis heard it and thought, this is how I want the film to sound. We were exploring the unknown. where we move objects all the way around the theater, which had never been done before.
I love that.
I know.
You really feel the helicopter moving.
Yes. Yeah, left to right. It's so cool. And what's so funny was that Walter had never done anything but mono film. So
not even in stereo.
Not even in stereo.
Much less surround sound.
I don't know. But that's what Francis thought he'd be doing. Little did he know he was changing cinema history.
And also the idea of layering all of those sounds. So you didn't just have the sound of the helicopter going by. You had dialogue, you had the background sound, then you had the famous music. All of that went into creating this dystopian mood of Apocalypse Now.
Yes, and he also did it in a way that, and I think he credits the British that they... Each person would take a different kind of effect. So like Pat Jackson, who she is in our movie, she did the boat, you know, that goes up the river and that they're on a lot of times. And somebody else did the ambiences. Mm-hmm. And then someone did all the weapons.
And when you say did, is that actually creating the sound?
It could be that on that, I think someone else might have gone out and recorded them. And then they edit. When I say did, for those guys, it would be like they were editing them into the movie. So a lot of times someone would go out and do the recording and then you would edit it into the movie.
So one guy who did that is a guy named Ben Burt. He's also legendary. He was the sound designer for Star Wars. And he came up with Chewbacca's famous grunts, gurgles, whatever they are.
Yes.
We were trying to find an animal that had enough vocal expressiveness in its sounds that we could use it for the Wookiee. So there was a young bear named Pooh, and we spent an afternoon with this bear in a pen, coaxing it to say different sounds.
The way they got it to make sound was to show it bread. It loved bread.
The bear would...
And then you give him the bread, and then he'd be like...
And then here he is talking about how he created the R2-D2 sound.
What eventually happened was, as George and I were talking to each other, we would say, well, R2 comes up to this point in the movie and he kind of goes, and suddenly we realized we were talking with expressive sounds. They had the intonation of meaning. We were verbalizing a sound that worked for us. And that led down the road of doing just that.
I was also fascinated to learn that none of the sounds in Star Wars were created by a synthesizer.
Yeah, none. He used a synthesizer to kind of combine things and to process things, a little, like the voice a little bit, but they didn't want that sound. George Lucas was really clear that he wanted this world to sound real and also old, have some age to it, not like everything's completely brand new, like a set. Like so many films were doing at the time, like Forbidden Planet or whatever. So, yeah, he wanted that real so we could relate to it.
So how did he create those little beep, bleep sounds?
Well, what he did is he combined things. He combined kind of a computer synthesized sound with his own voice, and he could play a couple different sounds at once and combine them.
So yeah. It's actually his voice is
yes,
R2-D2.
Yes, part of it is, yeah, his voice.
He also did the sound design for WALL-E.
Yes, and he's credited. He's in the Actors Guild because he's in SAG because, yeah, he really is the voice of WALL-E.
And the voice being not a voice, like another one
part,
of these.
Well, a piece of it is, yeah, a voice. But, you know, it's Ben can almost remember. It's like he's doing that voice. He almost got it exactly right. Mm-hmm. We found the clip that he sounds just like R2-D2. So that was, you know, partly his voice is in there.
And how did he change film sound design going forward?
Oh, my gosh. Well, okay, so let me just credit George Lucas for giving him a year before he even started to shoot in England. He had Ben go out and start collecting sounds. And if you always use something that's real, and especially something that's going to get us, like a lot of times now we use, you know, the growls and the, you know, like a car goes by, like I did, like even early on in my career, my first union show was Days of Thunder. And if a car goes by or suddenly there's a grill in your face, you know, like a big shot of a car, you put like an animal growl in there. And I think it just gets us as if we're still like cave people, like run, you know, something low, like low sounds. And it's like earthquake or...
Really? So the sound of cars is actually the sound of animals?
It can be, just like C.C. Hall does Top Gun.
But the jets themselves are not that interesting. They sounded kind of wimpy. So I created a library of mostly exotic animal roars, lions and tiger roars and monkey screeches. And that wound up being the thing. It gave them a cutting, sharp feeling.
And so it surprises you, you know. And we use those low kind of earthquake sounds to set people on edge.
Even if they don't know what it is that it's setting them on edge.
Yes.
Do you? So you're kind of manipulating us.
Oops. We don't like that word, but yes.
What word would you use?
Well, we're affecting, emotionally, we are affecting the audience.
Like, yeah, you're creating an experience.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, yeah. So it's really fun because sound is so much about emotion.
What about when you have a movie like, just a movie that's a small movie that doesn't need to have the sounds of animals or cars or planes or guns or bombs, like just people talking.
Yes. Well, you know, like the film Wild that Ai-Ling Lee did, and she's in the movie. And
this is the Cheryl Strayed
story.
She
is in nature. So that's like, and it's just like beautiful sounds of nature. But she uses those like the crickets or the cicadas to feel. You feel the heat and they just kind of rise. And, you know, the intensity of what she's feeling when she's, you know, really thirsty. But the other thing that we use that's so important is silence. And the truth is that silence isn't really silent.
I was going to say, it's not the absence of sound.
No, it's so quiet that you can hear that single cricket. And you know, then you hear the creaks of the floor or you hear somebody's breathing. Man, they're such good sounds. It doesn't have to be loud, you know. I mean, look at Hitchcock, too.
Yeah.
And Orson Welles, they were great at using sound well. Yeah.
Well, Orson Welles came from radio.
Exactly.
So he knew from sound.
I know.
But there's something about just the human voice, too.
Mm, I know. Yeah. And, you know, and so intimate. Like, when I'm cutting, I cut both sound effects and dialogue. When I cut dialogue, it's like I'll try to preserve the breath, you know, because you know. I mean, in actors, they study, you know, voice. They study voice. They study breathing techniques. And you can tell when someone's nervous or if they're about to cry, and you know that the breaths are just so precious and so important, and they tell us so much. Now we don't study that, but if you think about it, and sometimes because you won't hear someone's breathing unless you're really close to them, so it's really intimate, you know, it's a beautiful thing. And I think about that when I teach sound. I feel so privileged because I feel like I'm teaching people to listen and to appreciate their sense of hearing.
Well, I loved your movie.
Thank you. I love your show.
It's great to watch and to listen to.
Thank you.
Mitch Kostin, she's the director of the new documentary, Making Waves. It's in theaters now. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks so much. It's been fun.
Coming up, Kanye has put out a new gospel album. Is it any good? We'll tell you next on Press Play.